In what has been considered the biggest industrial catastrophe in the history of mankind, how well have government and media authorities reported on the damages done to and by the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility 2.5 years ago? How diligently have these authorities alerted the public in Japan and the west coast of North America to the risks associated with the meltdown of 3 reactors? Could the Fukushima plant be concealing a nuclear weapons facility? Yoshi Shimatsu, a science writer who has visited the Fukushima exclusion zone many times, shares his assessment of the situation in the first half hour. And what do documents released under the Freedom of Information legislation reveal about what happened in the early days of the meltdown? Why are mainstream and alternative media silent about the revelations coming from these recently released email and phone conversations? Patrick Penry, a.k.a. Tony Muga, has been studying these documents for months and trying to bring them to light. In our second half hour, he explains their contents and who is implicated in what he calls Plumegate, the world's largest provable conspiracy. On today's program, the Fukushima cover-up. Conversations with Yoichi Shimatsu and Patrick Penry. Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 6th, 2013. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM out of Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website at globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. At a time not so far distant, when just about everything is digital, when much of the world's internet traffic flows directly through the United States or allied countries, or through the infrastructure of American companies abroad, when search engines can find just about anything online in fractions of a second, when the Patriot Act and secret rulings by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court make Google and similar tech giants tools of the national security state, assuming organizations like the NSA don't simply take over the search business directly, and when the sophisticated technology can either block, alter, or delete digital material at the push of a button, the memory hole is no longer fiction. In at least one easy enough to imagine future, a set of Snowden-like revelations will be blocked or deleted as fast as anyone can repost them. The ever-developing technology of search turned 180 degrees will be able to disappear things in a major way. The internet is a vast place, but not infinite. It is increasingly being centralized in the hands of a few companies under the control of a few governments, with the U.S. sitting on the major transit routes across the internet's backbone. That's from the article, 1984 was an instruction manual, Welcome to the Memory Hole, Disappearing Edward Snowden, by Peter Van Buren, posted December 4th, originally published at tomdispatch.com. TEPCO is planning on dumping all of the radioactive water stored at Fukushima into the ocean. The industry-controlled nuclear regulators are pushing for dumping the radiation as well. Dr. Arjun Makhijani, a recognized expert on nuclear power who has testified before Congress, served as an expert witness in Nuclear Regulatory Commission proceedings and been interviewed by many of the largest news organizations, told PBS in March. We actually sent a proposal to Japan 2 years ago, some colleagues of mine and I, saying you should park a supertanker or a large tanker offshore and put the water in it, and send it off someplace else so that the water treatment and the water management is not such a huge constant issue. But the Japanese declined. So instead of doing something to contain the radiation, they're going to dump it. That's from They're Going to Dump the Fukushima Radiation into the Ocean by Washington's blog, posted December 4th. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, Washington quickly stepped into the place of Russia. Washington used NGOs funded by Washington and its EU puppets to create anti-Russian, pro-American, pro-EU movements in the former constituent parts of Soviet Russia. The gullible peoples were so happy to have escaped the Soviet thumb that they did not realize that they now had new masters. It is a good bet that the Ukrainian protests are a CIA-organized event using the Washington and EU-funded NGOs and manipulating the hatred of Ukrainian nationalists for Russia. If Ukraine can be realigned and brought into the fold of Washington's empire, Russia is further diminished as a world power. That's from Defeated by the Taliban, Washington Decides to Take on Russia and China by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted December 4th. Here's what Roslin wrote in 2011. After Japan's Fukushima catastrophe, Canadian government officials reassured jittery Canadians that the radioactive plume billowing from the destroyed nuclear reactors posed zero health risks in this country. In fact, there was reason to worry. Health Canada detected large spikes in radioactive material from Fukushima in Canadian air in March and April at monitoring stations across the country. For 22 days, a Health Canada monitoring station in Sydney detected iodine-131 levels in the air that were up to 300 times above the normal background levels. Radioactive iodine levels shot up as high as nearly 1,000 times background levels in the air at Resolute Bay, Nunavut. That's from Canada Busted Covering Up Spikes in Fukushima Radiation by Washington's blog, posted December 5th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This past Wednesday, December 4th, marked 1,000 days since the earthquake and tsunami which damaged the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility. The plant has spewed radioactive material into the air and water, and there seems to be no end in sight for this environmental calamity. Moreover, the governments of Japan, the U.S., and Canada, as well as the Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, have been far from honest about the state of the facility and the dangers lurking for Japanese citizens as well as the residents of North America and beyond. To help us better understand the clampdown on information and who is benefiting, we have on the line Yoichi Shimatsu. He is a freelance writer and former editor of the Japan Times Weekly. He's written extensively about the Fukushima disaster and has visited the 20-kilometer exclusion zone many times. He joins us now from Bangkok, Thailand. Thank you for joining us, Yoichi.
Well, it's good to connect with Global Research, yes.
You yourself have been to the exclusion zone. Maybe that's a good place to start. Well, what did you witness during those trips that have helped to grant some insights into exactly what has been covered up and how we've been misled?
My first visit there was in May after the disaster, a couple of months after the disaster. And at that point, the local residents I talked to, they realized that meltdowns were happening within 8 hours. After the tsunami struck. But since then, TEPCO has admitted that, actual meltdowns are occurring within 2 hours. This was totally denied. The fact that meltdowns were denied until the March 15th large explosion at Reactor 3. So right from the start, both the Electric Power Company and the Ministry of Economy and Industry, which is in charge of the nuclear industry, has basically been outright lying and giving us disinformation, misinformation, half-truth, in the rare half-truth, up to this point right now. And the deception is so great now that the ruling party, the Liberal Democrats, which basically built these nuclear power plants, is right in the midst, as we speak now, of ramming through a new security bill, which includes nuclear energy, basically, which would punish anybody within the system In fact, any citizen who comes across anything deemed secret, and it's not really clear, they're being very vague about what is secret, but clearly nuclear energy is involved, you're liable for a 10-year prison sentence. And for journalists, there's a very, strict rules too, that anything involving conspiring to reveal a secret, which means that basically just a discussion, let's say, with one of the workers inside the exclusion zone would be considered a conspiracy charge against a journalist. You would be liable then to a 5-year mandatory in prison sentence. So just mere possession of any kind of secret, just possession, not even reading it, just having it in hand. Let's say if you're a paper recycler, if you had a company like that, just having that in your warehouse for destruction would be enough for a 10-year jail sentence. So the government has massively overreacted to the disclosures by whistleblowers who have painted an entirely different picture of what's going on in the plant right from the beginning, including those first reports from villagers of massive troubles at the plant, which were then being denied. And as we've seen, the situation has gone much worse.
Now, yeah, you're speaking about the state secrets bill, as it's called. What do you have any thoughts about what the motivation is? I mean, is it merely an overreaction, or is there, some concerns there that they're trying to conceal?
Okay, what they've tried to conceal all along, and there's been little leaks and little inconsistencies and even information from TEPCO, which indicates that Reactor 3 that blew up, one of the contributing factors was MOX fuel. MOX is mixed oxide, MOX, okay? But it's a mixed oxide of uranium and plutonium. And the problem now at the Reactor 4 fuel pool, they're trying to remove some of the fuel rods in a very expeditious manner there and taking a high risk, is because Reactor 4 was secretly refitted by a team from General Electric and Hitachi. As March 11th disaster was occurring, they put in a new, what's called a shroud. It's a lining for the reactor there to upgrade it to be able to use this new MOX fuel. And the constituent elements in that fuel include a highly enriched plutonium. Okay, now the problem is Japan has a policy of trying to recycle plutonium in the fuel cycle of civilian nuclear plants. As you know, uranium produces, plutonium is produced inside nuclear reactors whenever you have, the normal uranium fission reaction. Plutonium is created. As time passes, you have large stock of plutonium, which is then concentrated in France, United Kingdom, and other places. TEPCO sends its spent fuel over to Europe, which then concentrates the plutonium and either keeps it in Europe or sends it back to Japan for storage. Now, what the policy of the Department of Energy in the United States and of the Japanese Ministry of Economics is to use that plutonium as a fuel source. And what happens, you get larger and more potent forms of plutonium created. Now, the inherent scientific problem there is that inside boiling water reactors, what happens is that the plutonium reactions transform the water inside that reactor into heavy water, into deuterium and into tritium. These are forms of water in which the hydrogen has one extra neutron. Tritium is with two extra neutrons. Now, the problem is that tritium and deuterium will make a reaction with plutonium, basically the same sort of thermonuclear reaction in the hydrogen bomb. That's why it's called a hydrogen bomb. It was a plutonium bomb that was dropped over Nagasaki, far more powerful than the hydrogen bomb dropped over Hiroshima. Now, among the 1,500 fuel assemblies inside spent fuel pool in a reactor form, 202 of them are of an unused fuel. Very interesting. It's a spent fuel pool. In other words, this is where you put your rods after you're done using them, and they have much less radioactive content than the original rod, the new rod. But they've got 202 new rods in there, while they were refitting reactor 4 for MOX. In other words, we've got 202 plutonium rods inside that spent fuel pool, and that is a great danger. That a third fire could easily break out, and possibly if enough tritium builds up in the water, you would have a thermonuclear reaction, which would detonate not only that immediate area, but there's another massive spent fuel pool only 50 meters away, which also, with the neutron flux from the flow of neutrons from a fire there, would trigger the other spent fuel pool. And what Prime Minister Naoto Kan later admitted at his speech in San Diego, I heard him there and wrote an article about it, he was afraid at the time of exactly this thing happening and of a series that the neutron flux from Fukushima 1 would be enough to trigger Fukushima number 2, the reactors there to blow, Onagawa up north, and Fukushima 1 and 2 combined would blow up Tokai Mura, would set Tokai Mura aflame and cause an explosion there, which would have forced the reaction, he was ready to sign an evacuation order in event of this series of four nuclear plants. We're not talking about reactors. We're talking about nuclear plants, massive numbers of reactors exploding with a force of evacuation of at least 50 million people from the Tokyo area and turn that area into a third of Japan into an uninhabitable zone. That's what he was afraid of. He's come out in public with this. And this is the nub of the whole lie of nuclear power, that this stuff isn't just about leakage. We're talking about the potential for massive explosions on the scale of nuclear warfare, forcing the evacuation of, at least a third of Japan and possibly more. Uncalculable deaths. If that had happened, of course, the roadways, all the electrical power systems across the world, there would be no way to evacuate. Tens of millions of people would have died.
Yoshi Shimatsu, is another element of this that I know you've also written about, the U.S.-Japan security treaty and the prospect of Fukushima being used for more than merely civilian purposes.
Oh, absolutely. Fukushima is not just two reactors. It's a vast, huge site by the ocean, with its own harbors, with which ships can come and go as they please without any detection. There's a huge Abukuma Mountain plateau there, rife with tunnels, hydro plants, apparently where tritium was made in the past. Southwest of Fukushima was a uranium thorium mine that was developed in the 1930s by militarist Japan, by the army, in cooperation with Nazi Germany. Okay, it was called Bund 1 site. So this area has been a center for Japan's atomic bomb production since the 1930s, okay? It's a remote area far from off the axis. It's not what people would normally, it's not a place most people would normally visit. There are secret sites up there, and I've stumbled upon some there of high radiation, south of Fukushima 1, and I've seen aerial photos of, I've witnessed massive excavations there before they even dealt with the nuclear, the melted down Fukushima 1. And also local people there in the mountains, knowing that I was visiting the mountain areas, it's a very tough area to visit. Roads are very scarce. There's one of the few places where roads that used to exist have been deliberately cut out. Villagers there warned me, you've got to be very careful in the mountains, because many times villagers, and this has been going on for decades, who stumble across certain places have been confronted by a secret, security force, and I asked them, army? Police, they said neither one. We don't know who they are, who detained them, questioned them, and finally turned them back. They said there's many secret sites in the mountains around Fukushima. I said, what could this possibly be? And everyone in Japanese style just sort of gives sort of a sick smile. It's pretty obviously clear that this whole area, far before nuclear energy was ever considered by anybody, it was already an atomic weapons production site. And a lot of plutonium has been introduced there, not just from England and France, but also secretly from the United States during the Bush and Cheney administration. There were massive transfers from Amarillo, Texas, the Pantex plant there, which involved the shooting of one of the CIA's port inspectors. A fellow named Roland Carnaby was shot amid these secret shipments that went out. to Japan. So obviously, the enrichment, and this is war-grade plutonium, Pantex, what they do is they disassemble nuclear warheads and take that spent plutonium out. Apparently, some of it was shipped to Japan. There was a team from Dimona, the Israeli nuclear atomic bomb production facility. We're on site at 311. They were doing the security cameras. They were installing security systems at Fukushima. So we see the United States, Israel, possibly France, deeply involved in secret production assistance for Japan's unconstitutional and illegal nuclear warhead program. Mm-hmm. Again, I have to emphasize, this has been going on since the 1930s in cooperation with Nazi Germany, and was resumed after the war under the Kishi government. Kishi, Nobusuke Kishi, the father of Japan's nuclear program, presided over the development of Japan's nuclear bomb in Manchuria and in North Korea. The North Korean bomb program was originally a Japanese bomb production site, okay, at Hongnam Island. Konan Island is what it's called in Japan. And upon his return to power, he's a class A war criminal with Berg, but upon his return to power in the Cold War, he's the one who initiated Japan's uranium production and nuclear program. And Shinzo Abe, the current prime minister, is very pro-nuclear and has now declared that Japan will continue with nuclear energy. He is the grandson of the founder of Japan's nuclear program. So this whole program has a lineage, a history to it, and a continuity. You wouldn't use nuclear warheads on your own country. You know, you would use them against another country. So it is a war-making instrument. So it's completely unconstitutional, and secrecy, therefore, must be maintained. And the U.S. government has not done what it's supposed to do. You know, they have a security agreement with Japan and secrecy and, defense issues, but clearly the United States was the occupation authority for the Allies when the Constitution was written. You know, American scholars worked on that Constitution. The U.S. also has an obligation to honor that very Constitution that it helped to, that if not say imposed on Japan, recommended to Japan. So there's a deep-seated conflict here between the Department of Energy and, let's say, the State Department in the United States. So there's a deep-seated conflict there over Japan's offensive weaponry power and nuclear, the use of nuclear weapons, peaceful use of nuclear energy, and the development of nuclear weapons. There's a huge conflict there inherent in American foreign policy.
Could you maybe share some insights you have, especially as a journalist, the extent to which the nuclear sector is calling the shots and clamping down on the free exchange and free inquiry that is absolutely essential in order to deal with the environmental impacts, the human impacts, the things that we need to hear but are not hearing? Where is the nuclear sector fit
well,
into
well,
that?
At the lowest, commonest level, you have a lot of these bloggers and trolls, people write letters to the editor who obviously are working, you know, are just basically voices of the nuclear industry trying to counter the critics of nuclear power. That's at the lowest level. At the next level, you have within the Japanese ministries, the Ministry of Economy is obviously the most equal among equals. It is a powerhouse along with which basically dictates to the other ministries what to do. So therefore, Ministry of Health, Education, and so on, people who run the schools. I was really alarmed in the early days, in those first few months, to see school children in shorts playing outside, inside Fukushima Prefecture, when the skies were like really strange. You know, they were weirdly illuminated. People were getting burns on their skin, including myself, radiation burns on our skin whenever we're outside. And children were encouraged to exercise outside by the Ministry of Education, which, by the way, runs the science ministry, which is in charge of the plutonium reprocessing work. Okay, so we see nuclear very much embedded in the health sector. Of course, the whole Hiroshima study, Nagasaki study, very much embedded into the Ministry of Health. So that's basically a taboo area since the end of World War II. At a higher level internationally, Japan plays a very strong role in the IAEA, along with partners U.S. and France, and has been able to basically prevent any kind of critique by the IAEA until a couple of months ago when some Ukrainian scientists from Chernobyl came in and were alarmed by what they saw, you know, radiation levels 6 times what they should be right at the border of the exclusion zone. They thought that there was, that was incredibly high. They were shocked. So the IAEA, and there's agreements between the IAEA and other UN-sponsored organizations, like the World Health Organization, which will defer all radiation issues to the IAEA for vetting. So therefore, the World Health Organization has issued a whitewash. At another level, too, the Tokyo Olympics. It turns out that I did some research, and it was run at the global research site, that showed every single one of the major global sponsors of the Olympics, International Olympics Committee, every one of them has vested either direct interest in nuclear energy and nuclear weaponry, or have members of their board who are, very much involved in the nuclear industry. Every single one of them, you know, from watchmakers to McDonald's even, which McDonald's, two of the board members there, are with the security, Continental Security, which does security for nuclear plants, including the San Onofre, the badly leaking San Onofre plant, Southern California Edison plant. So I don't know the full history of the membership, but certainly by the time of the 3-1 disaster, there was enough time for the nuclear industry to pack the corporate sponsorship before the London Olympics, okay? And that is how Tokyo won the its bid for the Tokyo Olympics, basically to suggest to the world that it's safe to come to Japan. The world nuclear industry wants to show that it's safe, because right now we're undergoing a major export push by the global nuclear industry to the developing world, places like Turkey, India, Dubai, the United Emirates. But and here in Southeast Asia, most alarmingly, the companies that built Fukushima 1, we're talking about Hitachi, Toshiba, and GE, have been pushing, have protocols with the government of Vietnam to put 8 reactors into Da Nang in central Vietnam. It's the largest and first major nuclear site in Southeast Asia. As you know, the plant in Philippines was canceled because it was built on a reactor. Other countries have put their nuclear plans on hold. But this is a really major push into Southeast Asia. And this place, Da Nang, as you know, is a surfing beach. It's a spit of sand. They're planning to build 8 nuclear reactors on a place that's vulnerable to tsunami and typhoons, hit by typhoons like 5 times a year. So this is an industry that's totally cynical. Right as we speak, the Japanese government has rolled back the policy to go non-nuclear within 30 years, 3 decades. As that's being rolled back now, that nuclear is a basic component of Japan's energy package. That's what the Abe government is now pushing. So despite this spreading disaster, you know, Fukushima is a global disaster. It's gone well beyond Japanese shores, far beyond Fukushima province. And it's right now, its effects are engulfing most of the world.
Very grim state of affairs. I think I have to call it ended there, but I want to thank you very much for coming on our show, Yoichi Shimatsu, and hopefully we can have you back again with more updates.
Okay, let's hope we survive that long.
Yes. We've been
disaster at reactor 4 spent fuel pool could put a quick end to all of our plans.
Yes. Yoichi Shimatsu is a freelance journalist and writer and former editor of the Japan Times Weekly. He's written extensively on Fukushima and has contributed to the Global Research News site. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission was subjected to a string of Freedom of Information requests in the days following the crippling of the nuclear facility in Fukushima, Japan. The documents released through these requests reveal that we've been deceived about the true nature of what happened at the complex and how dire the situation is there. Moreover, these official documents, which encompass email trails and transcripts of phone conversations among head officials, directly contradict the official story, including what we were told about current goings-on at the plant. Musician and citizen journalist Tony Muga, who goes by the pseudonym Patrick Penry, is largely responsible for bringing this documentation to the attention of the wider public. He has a complete archive on his site, patrickpenry.wordpress.com, and he joins us now from Gainesville, Florida. Thank you for joining us, Tony.
Thanks, Michael, and I appreciate the introduction there. You did a great job, and it's a pleasure and honor to be on your broadcast, because as I talked to you before, I mentioned I've referred to global research numerous times in my investigations, and a number of articles there have really been pieces of the puzzle for me to help me to put together a better picture. So I can thank you guys for that, if nothing else, right now.
Well, appreciate it very much, Tony, because it's certainly this does seem to be a what you've exposed seems to be quite a shocker. So it starts with these freedom of information requests. Could you, who exactly filed these freedom of information requests in the first place?
Well, initially there were a couple of groups that I'm aware of that filed for the documents. And Friends of the Earth was one group. The other group was the Associated Press. Now, there may have been other people in between, but I'm not aware of any other specifics. But between those two, and especially the Associated Press, I'm told, is sent off for about 90% of the requests. So if you go to the NRC website and you log in and you look, the vast majority of those, according to what my research indicates, are being filed by someone at the Associated Press. I'm not familiar with who, but that would be kind of who some of these environmental groups initiated and filed initially right after the event happened. By late June, early July, documents were beginning to collect into that online pool on the NRC database.
Mm. Okay, so you can connect, is there a pattern to, like you mentioned, both the Associated Press and environmental groups? Is there any kind of a pattern in terms of who's requesting what, or is it all pretty much the same territory?
It just seems to me, Michael, that at least with the Associated Press, because I think Friends of Earth just initially filed for a few documents here and there. AP has been consistently filing for them, and it just seems, if I were to make a guess, I think they're just making a wide-sweeping grab and trying to acquire as much of a range of information as possible. I can't specifically look and say, oh, they're trying to get this kind of telephone transcript or this specific date or so on and so forth. So I think it's just a wide-range grab to get all the transcripts and telephone conversations, emails, all that kind of information, and get it into a body on the NRC website where you or I or anyone can go in there and research and get into it.
Hmm. Now, how did you come to discover this information?
Okay, initially there was a website online. I've been critical of some of these websites because they didn't give that much information. They could have done so much more. But to their credit, E-Informable, as a Lucas Hickson site, and Joy Thompson was, I don't know if she still writes with Informable or not, but she had a really great article early on that called it a can of worms. It opened up a, quote, can of worms, and I thought to myself, yeah, this is worms, all right. So, but I will say this, Michael, on the whole, it's been very suppressed. I'm studying controlled opposition since February of 2012 when I would send this information out, myself and other researchers, and it was largely ignored. And we didn't cover everybody. Like, I never contacted Michael Rupert. I don't know why I never did. I never thought of it. But I sent to other websites and alternative media outlets, and they basically ignored it. So I liken it to a fumble on the football field. And I'm looking around at all these better runners and better players, and they don't pick up the ball. And so I just grab it and run a few feet and set it down.
Hmm. Well, yeah, it's... Yeah, like how do you interpret that? I mean, you mentioned the term controlled demolition. Is there possibly a simpler explanation? Maybe just what was that? I guess there's that saying: the bigger the lie, the harder it is to believe.
Well,
that
that's true, and they're they have a very well put together false scenario and a false accountability of what the damage, what happened there. In this book I'm writing now, I'm going to explain and go into greater detail. Yes, there's a cover-up to protect our nuclear industry. But if you want to look at that tsunami drill and go into the conspiracy theory area, I believe there's other reasons as well. I'm going to flesh that out in this book I'm working on now. So I'm tend to write now just, you know, until I've done more research and done some more. So far, my hypothesis is held watertight, but until I'm really confident with it and I finish this thing I'm writing right now, I just kind of want to hold off on that. So what we, like I say, with Rupert, I told him we can all agree that, that there was some damage there. We know it was pretty catastrophic, and just judging from the amount of damage and the effects of what that are going to be, I think in an open forum and discussion, most informed Americans would agree with us that as soon as we can, we need to start looking into some means of decommissioning plants and providing some alternative means of power. Maybe even Americans saying to themselves, we might need to adjust our lifestyles a little bit and maybe not use so much power.
Now, the documentation that was disclosed, it includes email trails, but also includes transcripts of phone conversations. Is this like among head officials? These sorts of conversations, is that essentially a requirement that in all of these discussions that they're all recorded?
That's my understanding, Michael, that there's in an emergency like this. In fact, they actually do transcriptions from all their meetings around the country, public meetings. The NRC documents pretty much everything they do. And there's an emergency or some kind of event, the recorders are on, they're keeping everything, but the thing is, my understanding is, you won't ever even hear that unless someone files for the transcripts and the phone conversations. Yes, they record it, but unless somebody out here on the outside world requests it, you know, they just hold on to it and, you know, might not get to see anything at all if we're not requesting it. So Freedom of Information Act, I tell you, it's one of the most beautiful things this country has going for it.
Yeah, it's like certainly, I mean, even in dealing with, police officers, I mean, they'll basically be able to get away with things by not, as long as you don't know your rights, they're not sort of obliged to tell you, and they can capitalize on that. So it sounds like the same kind of principle.
Very similar, exactly. Good example.
Okay. Now, let's talk about some of these main disclosures. I know one of them has to do with the spent fuel pool number 4. Now, just to define our terms, I mean, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about a spent fuel pool?
Okay, that's where the fuel that has been in the reactor and been used to its full potential, at least according to our current technology, once they're done with that fuel, and it's in a very excited, heated state. It's very hot. You have to put it into a temporary holding pool with a special coolant water that's circulating to keep it cool. And it has to stay there a number of years until the temperature comes down enough where they can offload it into what's called a dry cask and then store it, you know, for long-term storage somewhere else. So that spent fuel pool is it's many meters deep. I'm not exactly certain how many meters, but these control rods are many meters long. A person can't just lift one up yourself. They have that big machine, take them in and out, as many have seen in the TEPCO videos alleging to be Unit 4. So it's simply just a temporarily temporary place to hold these heated fuel rods until they cool enough to dry cast them for permanent storage.
Okay. Now, what we've been told in recent weeks, starting on the 18th, that there is a major operation to remove fuel rods from the assemblies in these spent fuel pools to do it safely. And there's been a lot of controversy of whether or not TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Corporation, is competent enough to do all that. And, a lot of associated commentary coming from experts like Arne Gunderson. But what have you revealed about spent fuel pool number 4 that would seem to, contradict a lot of the current news we're hearing?
Okay, first, I quickly want to say that I'm not an absolute expert on nuclear power, but there are other people who are, but they don't want to speak out about these documents. So to be clear, I'm kind of learning as I go along, and if I make a mistake, I'll go back and, like today on your show, I kind of made a correction from FOIA stuff on Rupert's show. I misspoke about these documents are ongoing and so on and so forth. So I just want to be clear, I'm not expert. The ones who are, I would say, are kind of remaining quiet on these documents. Now, that being said, with spent fuel pool number four, in these documents, there on number four, there's a mountain of evidence. I mean, it's huge. I could write another giant article again with all new stuff because it's consistent that four had some kind of a leak and loss of inventory. And when that happened, there's what they call a zirconium fire, the cladding on the spent fuel. It reaches a temperature where it bursts into flames. It's very difficult to extinguish. It's called a pyrophoric fire. You can't just spray water on it necessarily. It's like magnesium burning. So in these documents, there's just so much evidence that there's a melt on the floor, rubble on the floor, walls blown out. I mean, I kind of beat a dead horse when I start reading from this one document because it's so obvious to me, you know. And then when Rupert looked into this stuff and felt so strong about it, that made me feel even better because always in my mind, I always double-check and rethink, and I try and, you know, hammer, debunk my own stuff if I can. And so far, this is pretty watertight. If you look at the TEPCO footage, there's nothing conclusive that doesn't say it's not stock footage or they're shooting it down at Diani. And TEPCO's notoriously inaccurate with their information, I'll put it that way. So just a wealth of information in there, that walls blown out, loss of inventory, zerk fire. The IAEA admitted to a 9-hour fire in the spent fuel pool. So compare that to what everybody else is saying. And somewhere along the line, there's a massive schism between on the one hand, that the spent fuel pool is they're going to unload the fuel. On the other hand, there's probably not any fuel left. You know, one of the two is wrong.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, you're talking about, and I appreciate that clarification, but you are pointing to documentation, which is the official.
This is the Freedom of Information Act. This is, anyone can go online, look at the documentation. On my book, I link on my multiple smaller articles and all my videos. I have plenty of links and everywhere. And like Michael Rupert said to a detractor who was accusing me of putting up fake emails and stuff, if anyone were to do that, that is a major federal offense that they will definitely throw your butt in jail, your door will be kicked in, and you're gone. So it's all drawn from the NRC, Freedom of Information Act. And might I say, the information in there is so damning, and nobody needs to make anything up. Just what's already there paints an incredible picture of this grandiose orchestrated cover-up, whatever their reasons are for doing it. You know, and I'm working on that in my new book, is to try to give more reasons as to what's going on the global chessboard that's unfolding here.
Talking about the global, what about the effects in terms of the radiation that was released, the plume that's gone up over Japan and towards North America? Is there anything revelatory there that needs to be brought to the public's attention in terms of what was known at the time?
Well, immediately following the accident, if you read those documents, you know just on their own testimony alone that they were aware there were some massive releases. I mean, they pretty much knew it was what they call a worst-case scenario. That means there's no water, no electricity, no coolant for days and days on end. I found a piece in there by Chuck Cass, who was the lead in the response team in Japan from the NRC, and he's been consistent all along that how severe the damage was early on. So if you, even without the FOIA documents, if you study Chernobyl and read the cost and consequences study, I link to this on my blog and website. If you read the one really legitimate study, you know that you just don't get out of one of these accidents without there being some kind of effect as far as mortality rate, heart problems, mutation, genetic defects, leukemia, that kind of thing. If I take that and I just, in my mind, think about how Fukushima is playing out and the releases from all these source terms, what they call it, each reactor or spent fuel pool that would produce radiation, it's absolutely ridiculous to assert that there would be no effect over here. Like I say, there's been a number of studies now. You can look at the Sherman-Mangano mortality index study that's been revised and updated. There's an online activist, Bobby One, who has a very excellent, very well-researched mortality index study as well. And then you have recently the thyroid study that I believe Busby, Sherman and Mongano participated in as well. And if you look close, you can hear about cancer clusters and starfish dying and all this. I mean, it's right in our face, but I think denial is some kind of coping mechanism for a lot of people, Michael, and they're just trying to cope right now. I'm not saying it's an extinction-level event. I'm not going that far because I don't know. I don't know. Mm. But I think a lot of people are in denial about the ongoing effects. They're kind of obvious to me. And keep in mind, let me finish here, that in the studies from Chernobyl, it's always like 5 years plus down the road that the latent cancers and effects really kick in. So we're just on the border, on the cusp of really feeling some of the effects from this catastrophe.
Mm. Now, as you mentioned, it's a requirement that in an emergency situation that all of the communications are documented. And that leads me to believe that, I mean, if there is a cover-up going on, that you're really kind of having to read between the lines, because I would imagine that people who know that they're being recorded would be kind of guarded in the way they convey their information. Even though there's a lot that's come out already, I mean, are you having any sense of sort of deeper things that are not being said that you're having to kind of piece together?
Okay, well, there's certainly redaction. For instance, there was a page that said spent fuel pool number 4 boil off calculation. And then you had 20 pages that were blank. Total redaction. So, no, I didn't get to see that. But when I combine that with everything else on unit number 4, I'm like, yeah, it's a lot worse than what they're letting on. And you make a great point. Some of them now, not everybody's in on the conspiracy now. It's not that big of a conspiracy. On the lower level, I'm convinced some people are newbies and rookies just coming in. They don't know. One guy's almost kind of reprimanded when he gets carried away, and he's talking about Unit 4, melt on the floor. If it sublimates, will it go into the torus? And the guy says, hey, just so you're aware. He doesn't say, shut up, we're being recorded, although in one part I got, the guy says, hey, we're on a recorded line. You know, we need to take it to a non-recorded line so they're aware they're being recorded. Some of them are actually, you're correct, they have to edit what they say. They're not as revealing. And I did a broadcast on Blog Talk Radio, my Blog Talk Radio show when I used to do it, where I talked about the NRC's response to a catastrophe is actually inhibited because some players are aware they're being recorded and they're editing what they say, and so they're not forthright and forthcoming with information, so the communication is inhibited. And I liken it to firefighters showing up at your house to put out a fire, and they can't say the word axe and they can't say the word hose. They'll still put the fire out, but it might not be in this short of time, if you understand.
Hmm. I would be watchful of those things that officials are saying among themselves, but they say something completely different to the wider public. Obviously, you have that blatant example with the spent fuel pool 4, but I mean, I think you also mentioned the whole issue of potassium iodide and, how they seem to stress it more when they speak among themselves than when they speak to the wider public. Have you come across several other examples like that? Or?
Well, that's very observant of you. Yes, what I found in the back of my book, Something Wicked This Way Comes, I have a section on potassium iodine, KI, and I've got a collection of screen captures from emails. For instance, I'm trying to think if it was Chuck Casto or who it was had forgotten their stash of potassium iodine, and someone was trying to ship some out and get it to him as soon as possible, because throughout these documents, they make no bones about it. They don't leave here and go over there without their potassium iodine. Whilst on the public front, to my understanding, they're kind of, indifferent about it and don't want the public to think they really need it. It only treats you for iodine and won't get you for other radioactive substances. Not that big a deal. But, if you're in a pit full of snakes and there's 6 different snakes and someone gives you the antidote to one snake, well, that's only 5 left, and I'd rather only have 5 snakes after me than 6. So.
Mm. Well, I guess that gets us to the question of motive. Just to try to clarify, what in terms of what your the exhaustive thousands of hours of research you've done into this, do you have any? Have you come to any conclusions about who is benefiting from covering up this information? Is it about basically straight, you know, protecting people's asses? Are they concerned that there could be a national panic and everybody's going to want to move from the West Coast of North America? Is there, you know, profits at stake? What's the ultimate motive here to this whole scheme?
Well, first of all, to be realistic, well, first let me say, yes, they protect the nuclear industry, obviously, but that's the obvious indication there. But they're also, the cover-up is, let's see how I phrase this. They're protecting the nuclear industry, yes, but to some extent, you can't be completely honest considering, considering our position around the world with all these nuclear plants and considering their vulnerability in relation to large population centers. This is what I want to say. You cannot be forthright and completely honest. You simply can't, make excuses for our government, but if they came out and said, yes, we got to evacuate, you got to get out of Tokyo, or Indian Point's melted down, you got to get out of New York, it's not feasibly possible to evacuate those people. You just cannot do it. And so in their defense, I understand that. But my point in that is that just strikes to the fact we need an alternative source of power, and we need to dry cast this stuff and shut these things down as soon as possible. So the cover-up is twofold. Protect the nuclear industry in the short term, but I mean, I think in the long term, we're going to have to shut this stuff down regardless. There's no other way around it. And I think they probably know that in the higher levels of government now.
Hmm. I want to go back to what you were discussing right at the outset, that the Associated Press being responsible for filing so many of these Freedom of Information requests in the first place, and you having gone to all that trouble, and it doesn't seem like they're doing anything with it. I mean, Associated Press, that's mainstream, right? That's the biggest news wire in the world, I believe. And
that's correct, but when I'm told, I don't know who it is, but I'm told there's one person down there that continues to file and put this evidence on the NRC database. So while on the one hand it's true, Associated Press is not pulling from, you know, what I'm looking at, the worst of the worst in these documents, if anything at all. Someone down there is doing something and stockpiling for those who are willing to look into it. So it seems to me like somebody's trying to do something, while overall, yes, mainstream, totally silent across the board, and alternative media until recently has been very much silent across the board.
Oh, okay. So what just occurs to me as you're saying that is that they're looking to this information. They want the information, but not with the intention of disseminating it to the wider public.
Correct, because you have to understand that in those higher level positions or any position in the mainstream media, AP, ABC News, Reuters, whatever have you, they have to answer to their boss, and I've looked into this extensively. There's repercussions if you do try to. Okay, let me say this. In these documents, Michael, you can see where the NRC, and they spend millions to search press, could be mainstream, could be alternative. They want to know who's writing about them, who's talking about them. Throughout these documents, you see reports coming in on who's writing about Fukushima, who's writing about the NRC. It's mainstream, too. I've seen a couple articles come out in mainstream that weren't that shabby, but they get reported on, NRC knows about it, and they say in one of these emails after Fukushima that they watch social media, they got a feel for what's going on, they send their bloggers out to help set the record straight. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but that's generally what they do. They watch, it's reported to them, and they countermeasure and come out and, you know, I just read an article where Entergy spends millions to hire online PR people to convince us to relicense Indian Point, which is kind of like our Fukushima waiting to happen next to New York City, if you think about it.
Hmm. Well, it looks like our truth tellers have our work cut out for us, given that kind of, those sorts of counterattacks that may be on the horizon. So what about, briefly, I mean, you've already made some forays into getting this. You've been at it for months, and you have the internet as the ally. You talk as an ally. You talk to Mike Rupert and Blog Talk Radio. What are some of the your experiences in terms of getting this to the wider public? They hits, the misses, some of the things you might caution against.
Well, my experience getting out to the public has been kind of frustrating, because for the longest time I would send the information out and post on YouTube channels and try. I would do videos that were remixable. All you had to do was punch a few buttons and copy my video, and I found just an incredible resistance to this information going out. And I think there's more to it, though, Michael, in the long run. I hope this piece I'm writing now is going to shed more light on this global picture, why there's such silence. And I'll just hint right now, and you guys have shown this on Global Research. I've seen some good articles on there. I am more coming to understand the dynamics between some of these superpowers in the world and the corporations behind those superpowers and the needs of those corporations and what's going to be playing out on this planet in the future. And I've seen some channels on YouTube called Weather Wars and that kind of thing. That's what I'm interested in right now, these untraceable weapons, tsunami bombs, like General Cohen said, earthquakes induced by electromagnetics, volcanoes excited by electromagnetics. If you look back at the Icelandic volcano not too long ago, what was the end result of that? Well, it held up air traffic. People were stuck in airports. It brought an economy almost to a standstill. I'm thinking, hey, that could be an economic attack. What's going on this planet? So I'm kind of looking into that right now to see, is there this sublime, silent war that is unfolding on Earth right now between these superpowers, and resources are dwindling. And I certainly understand that from some of Rupert's work. So, and back in the day, I took an honors class based on Jared Diamond's book called Collapse. So I went back into that book and started looking at the Mayans and some of these reasons why civilizations collapse. It's very interesting and very revealing, and hopefully my next piece is going to shed more light on that.
Okay, well, Patrick Penry, Tony Muga, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you and to help bring your research forward. Again, your website is hattrickpenry.wordpress.com, and your book is Something Wicked This Way Comes. Is there anything else you wanted to relay to our listeners before we close?
You can catch me on YouTube, and I have some original songs. I really prefer to be a musician, but if there's need for someone to write, I'm willing to do that. And I just want to give you a word of thanks, and I want to give Global Research a little bit of praise, because really, by having me on now, as far as I'm concerned, in my humble opinion, you guys have really legitimized yourself as covering a very broad range of topics right now. I mean, I've seen almost anything and everything come across your website. So really, now you've gone into the FOIA documents, you've covered the Plumegate thing, and you guys are doing an excellent job.
Okay. We really appreciate that, Tony, and certainly we appreciate the hard work you put into this this effort on your part. So thanks again for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Tony Muga, otherwise known as Hattrick Penry. He has revealed a number of documents that have been put forward to the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission relating to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster. And that marks the end of our show for this week. We would like to welcome our newest partner, Port Perry Radio in Port Perry, Ontario, which airs the Global Research News Hour Thursdays at 1 p.m. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.